Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Hello and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm your host, Dan Perkins. Hartford, Connecticut. Connecticut governor says legalizing marijuana would prevent COVID spread by reducing travel to New Jersey. The governor of Connecticut says that legalizing marijuana in his state will bolster public health amid the coronavirus pandemic by preventing cannabis tourism to surrounding states as they pursue and enact the policy change. In an interview with Yahoo Finance, Governor Ned Lamont said that officials had to think regionally when it comes to how to deal with the pandemic, and we think we have to think regionally when it comes to marijuana as well. The governor said, right now I'm surrounded by states. She mentioned New Jersey, Massachusetts, where marijuana is already legal, and I don't need a lot of people driving back and forth across the border. We're trying to keep people close to home as best we can right now, and I think legalizing marijuana and doing it safely, making sure that nope is laced in the product. I think it is one way to keep people closer to home. New Jersey voters approve a referendum to legalize cannabis during Tuesday's election, but it should be noted that marijuana possession, use, and sales remain prohibited there until lawmakers approve enabling legislation for the program. Governor Phil Murphy announced on Friday the appointment of two top regulators for the cannabis system. Beyond New Jersey, even South Dakota voted to legalize marijuana, as well as 15 other states where it is legal right now. The governor went on to say that there is a fair amount of history in the combined 15 states plus Washington, D.C. Democrats increased their majority in Connecticut state legislature this week during the election, boosting their chances of legalization can get done in 2021. South Dakota voters made a wrong choice on marijuana legalization, the governor says, as lawmakers weigh the challenges. South Dakota voters spoke decisively when they legalized both medical and recreational marijuana during Tuesday's election. But the state governor says that this was the wrong choice, and a top lawmaker is voicing concern about implementing the adult use program, which is now protected in the state constitution. I personally was opposed to these measures and firmly believe that they're wrong choice for South Dakota communities, Governor Kristi Noem told reporters. We need to be finding ways to strengthen our families. I think we're taking a step in the backward in that effort. Meanwhile, House Speaker Stephen Hoggard said on Wednesday that the broader legalization initiative contains a number of provisions that will have to be addressed legislatively. You really need to figure out if a constitutional amendment is sufficient in itself, clarifies some of those issues. I suspect we're going to have some challenges to this for a long time. The constitutional amendment for adult use cannabis will make it so people 21 and older will be able to possess and distribute up to 1 ounce of marijuana, and they will be allowed to cultivate up to 3 cannabis plants. Upon formal passage, legalization will become law on July 1st, 2021. The Department of Revenue will be charged with developing licensing regulations by April 1st, 2022. Washington, D.C. Schools and NCAA could ban marijuana sponsorship under bill to let student-athletes monetize their success. A new bipartisan congressional bill aimed at helping student-athletes monetize their success contains a provision that would let colleges and intercollegiate organizations block them from making sponsorship deals with marijuana businesses. While the legislation would address a long-standing controversy of inequitable payment to college athletes, drug policy reform advocates are disappointed to see the legalization perpetuate anti-cannabis policies despite a growing state-level legalized movement. The Student Athlete Level Playing Field Act, introduced by Representative Nancy Gonzalez, Republican of Ohio, and 7 other original co-sponsors, would make it so colleges and associations like the NCAA would not prohibit students from being involved in intercollegiate athletics if they've entered into a sponsorship agreement. However, it stipulates that the exception would be for sponsorship if it's from the seller or dispensary of controlled substance, including marijuana. Student drug policy reform advocates took exception to the cannabis provision. And our final story comes from Los Angeles, California. FBI raids office and homes of California officials in cannabis corruption probe. The Federal Bureau of Investigation last week raided the offices and homes of officials in California as part of the cannabis-related corruption inquiry, Southern California News Group reported. Search warrants were executed at the offices of Baldwin Park City Attorney Robert Tafoya. The homes of Compton's councilman and San Bernardino County Planning Commissioner were also raided. FBI spokeswoman Laura Miller confirmed the searches, but did not outline the specifics about the action because the warrants are sealed. She indicated that there were no arrests made as part of the probe. Chavez, who is the San Bernardino County Planning Commissioner, said he was mystified, as anyone else, by the FBI raid, during which agents only seized his laptop. Later, he said he had turned in his cell phone to the FBI West Canova field office. And that's your American Cannabis Conversation quick news update. Now let's see who's joining the conversation this week, mostly about the election and the results of voting on cannabis in various states. Morgan Fox, the public affairs director for the National Cannabis Industry Association, gives the industry take on what happened and why it was so important. Next, we're joined by John Kager, who's been on the show before from the New Frontier Data Corporation, which is a great source for information what's going on in the cannabis industry. Next, we have Mike Regan, our money guy, who's going to talk to us about the economic impact of this changes in legislation. And finally, we have a new guest, Susan Shearer, who is the founder of Heavenly Hash Creamy Products, a high-protein, high-fat content ice cream, great for people with suffering from side effects from chemotherapy and other ailments. I sampled the ice cream. It is amazing. Thanks for joining. I'm Dan Perkins, and let's join the conversation. Welcome back to the conversation, and joining me today is an incredible guest. I've actually sampled her product, and I'm a snob when it comes to ice cream, but you're wondering, why are we going to talk about ice cream? You're going to find out in just a minute. We have Susan Shearer from an interesting name of an ice cream company, Heavenly Hash Creamery. Susan, thank you for joining us today at the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Let's start off today talking about you and how you came to create this incredible product and why you did it.
Sure. So my background is nursing. It's in oncology and critical care, and I've had a lot of experience being around patients and at different phases of their lives, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and nutrition was always an important aspect to their care. And at one point, I had a company that was an oncology nurse navigation company, and so we navigated patients and their families through all the aspects of their cancer care, including nutrition. And around 2018, we saw a gap in the market when it came to products like Ensure and Boost. Here's these high-protein products, but unfortunately, they didn't taste very good. And when you have one out of four cancer patients that pass away from something called cachexia, which is muscle wasting, it makes it really difficult to get them any kind of food. And so it just seemed like a really good idea to have ice cream as a medical delivery system because it's something that everybody enjoys. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what we did. And we also decided, you know what, the other benefit to this is the fact that you can add CBD to it. And we knew that our patients were also using cannabis as an alternative to things like Zofran and other medications that had kind of a horrible side effect profile. And so here's a benefit. You get this super premium ice cream that's high in protein, and you're able to add cannabis to it and also in flavors that stimulated their salivary glands if they couldn't taste anything. And it made sense, so we called it Heavenly Hash Creamery.
It's an amazing product. As I said before we came on the air, I got some samples yesterday and consumed one. Your package, if I'm reading your labeling correctly, you got 30 milligrams of CBD in one serving?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have 30 milligrams and then 50 milligrams in another. And, you know, just for the record, I didn't think that I was going to go into this business. I didn't see myself going into manufacturing. It wasn't until about 4 months before I founded the company that I had a personal issue where my husband had passed away unexpectedly. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I felt that when the idea came to me that it had originated from him. And so that's where also the Heavenly comes from, when we talk about Heavenly Hash ice cream. So, you know, both companies were about increasing the quality of life in others. And so that's what the passion and the mission of this company is to be able to have ice cream as a delivery system to help a lot of patients and a lot of the people that consume our ice cream.
If people go to your website, so why don't you tell them what it is right now?
It's www.heavenlyhashcreamery.com.
Now, I've been there a number of times, and I've sent to people to that. And one of the things that impressed some of the doctors that I've already talked to is your attention to the compound and the ingredients that you put into this ice cream with mm-hmm. a concern about adverse reaction to chemotherapy. Talk about that a little bit.
So, you know, it's very important to develop a product that raised the bar as far as CBD products to begin with, but also nutritional products. I wanted a product that somebody just wanted to eat because it tastes really good. So with the high fat content, it puts it in a super premium category, like Haagen-Dazs and Ben & Jerry's. And then what we wanted to do was make sure that it was kosher. I purposely kept any kind of soy out of the product. That was because of my exposure to breast cancer patients who are trying to stay away from soy products, which is a natural estrogen. And if you have an estrogen cancer, which means that there's receptors on the cancer cell that like estrogen and want to grow, you're trying to block that. And so it was important to make sure that was in place. Because of the high fat content, the caseins in the product is real low. So for people that are lactose intolerant, they can handle this product. And to give you an idea of how low it is, our product, when you measure the lactose in it, is between 0.84 grams to 2.5 grams. And you're probably saying, you know, what does that mean? Well, for a cup of skim milk, that's 13 grams. So that tells you that you can really tolerate this, even if you're lactose intolerant. It was important to make it gluten-free. Again, we're a company about increasing the quality of life, so it was important to make things in sustainable packaging. When it came to working with the state, which we did, Florida is the only state that allows hemp infusion into dairy. And so we worked really closely with the state on the hemp rules and making sure that the product had all the necessary labeling. Not only did they get a COA from, which is a certificate of analysis that discussed what was in the product, but it also, you know, it shows any kind of metal testing, pesticides, it went further. And so trying to give patients as much and consumers as much information as possible, and that's what we did. So we paid a lot of attention to detail. We probably took about a year to do it. We get asked, you know, what kind of sugars do you use? And we use a natural cane sugar that's out of the Everglades. And we did that because I didn't want to use sugar alcohols. So when you look at other products that say that they're sugar-free or the sugar content's real low, they usually use an alcohol, and that's very disturbing to the GI system and can cause a lot of bloating and GI problems. So we wanted to make sure that the ingredients were the finest ingredients that we could put into the product and really raise the level for both the ice cream but also for the cannabis side.
Now, as I understand this, Susan, you have a cannabis and a non-cannabis product.
Correct.
And you chose to do the non-cannabis because?
So we decided to do the non-cannabis because, you know, it's still very early in the market, and there are people that are cannabis naive or they don't understand the differences. There's still this stigma. And it was important to get this product because the company's, you know, mission is building a health and wellness ice cream brand, frozen dessert brand. So it was important to get that into the healthcare institutions. And with a lot of institutions getting their federal funding from the government and from the state, and we want to pretty much, you know, make them an outlier because we also are involved in the cannabis industry. And it got the name out there. So you started to see Heavenly Hash Creamery as a product that would help the consumer. And then by adding HHC Plus, introducing the CBD line into markets that actually allow us to do that, just seemed like a natural fit. As we move down the line, we will be splitting the two brands off. One will have Heavenly Health, and the other one will stay Heavenly Hash Creamery as we continue to do our development.
So if you could just step back for a second and tell us again about the process that you went through with the state of Florida. You went through that really fast, and there's a lot there, but let's unpack that a little bit. Tell us again what Florida did when they heard about your product.
Well, you know, in 2018, when we were trying to figure out if this is a product that would even move, you know, we pretty much did a test the market and had it in 20, 40, 60, 80 milligrams. And, of course, at that point, Florida wasn't ready for this. We were deciding what we were going to do with hemp and regulation and CBD, and it was kind of a gray area. And we decided once we got the feedback that we would stop production, work on the base formula where you're seeing all those, the gluten-free and everything that we had worked on. And then had conversations with the state as they were trying to form their hemp rules. And knowing that we had a product, the credibility of what we do as a company was very important to them. In 2017, I actually wrote a law for the state of Florida. I wrote a law that changed the Patient Bill of Rights, which allows every patient in the state of Florida to have a person of their choosing to an inpatient or outpatient healthcare facility while receiving care from your physician. And so because I was already introduced to that arena and doing lobbying in Washington on behalf of cancer patients, they knew that where we were coming from as a company was to bet for the betterment of the industry and also for the betterment of the consumer. And so they were very much engaged. We talked about what we would do with the hemp. We actually invited them to our runs. They were there when we ran our first runs with the ice cream. They tested the ice cream up in Tallahassee. And knowing that we are basically the poster child for wholesale manufacturing of CBD ice cream, you know, other states are looking at our Department of Ag and saying, okay, how are you doing this? And so it was really important that we work very closely together and to make sure that even the process of testing the ice cream was streamlined. When you have a new product that's never been tested before and people don't know how to test it, obviously you can get different ranges and it can be really confusing. So we'll work out all the bugs before Unilever. So Ben & Jerry's can thank us later on. But it's been a very interesting ride. It's definitely not for the faint of heart.
Susan, in doing this, you sounds like you opened up your books in the terms of recipe and formulation and told your competition what you're doing. That was a big risk to take.
Yeah, I mean, they don't know how. I mean, we do have a proprietary way of how we infuse the ice cream. You know, when you're making a continuous freeze process at, 12 to 14,000 cups coming off a line, that has stayed pretty consistent. Mm-hmm. There is a proprietary way of doing that. Recipes are recipes. You can't really patent them.
Right.
It's the process of how we do that. And getting a consistent product, as you know, and a cannabis product is very difficult because the plant itself is not uniform, right?
Right.
So
right.
It's really, really to get down to being able to stay within a certain range or stay within a certain milligram is very, very difficult. And it took a very long time to be able to do that. And so there are things that we've done that aren't exposed, but as far as, our flavors, you can look at the ingredients on the label, you know what's in there, you just don't know exactly how we made it, which is just
good,
fine.
Good. We're almost out of time on this segment. Would you please tell people how they can find out more of information about Heavenly Hash?
Sure. If you go to the website, www.heavenlyhashcreamery.com, and you're looking for, there's a Where to Buy button. That's, you'll see distributors, because we actually do have distributors that distribute to retail locations. We don't sell out of our locations, so you want to go on there and look into your zip code, and you'll find the locations that are around your area.
Terrific. We've been speaking to Susan Shear of Heavenly Hash CBD Infused Ice Cream. If you missed any part of this interview with her, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, go to the archive section, and listen to her. It's a great story. We'll be right back.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is Morgan Fox, our industry representative from the National Cannabis Industry Association. And welcome to the program, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
I guess you must be really busy with the recent election, doing lots and lots of interviews. So I know your time is precious. We'll try and do this as quickly as possible. Give me your take on the ballot initiatives across the country.
Aside from the fact that this is going to be opening up five new regulated cannabis markets in the coming years, I think that there are a lot of really amazing things about this election. So just a little breakdown, Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota all passed adult use initiatives by pretty decent margins, particularly in New Jersey, where it was supported by 10 points more than the second highest or second most popular ballot initiative for legalization in history, which was California. Just really shows how far we've come in the last 4 years. South Dakota voters also overwhelmingly passed a medical ballot. And, that basically makes that South Dakota, being a very conservative state, was also the first state to jump completely over medical and pass an adult use initiative without having an established medical cannabis system already in place. And then we had Mississippi overwhelmingly voted in favor of medical cannabis as a concept. And then when given the choice between a patient-focused and advocate-driven initiative and a very restrictive initiative that was put on the ballot by lawmakers to try to split the vote, voters overwhelmingly chose the better initiative. So really across the board, we're looking at a clean sweep for ballot initiatives related to cannabis in this country over the past week.
Now, historically, when a initiative went on the ballot, the time to implementation after it was passed by the voters could be several years. As I understand it, the regulatory authority in New Jersey indicated earlier this week, if the initiative passed in New Jersey, the existing medical marijuana places would be quickly certified to the point that they could begin to sell recreational or adult use, and the guy was saying approximately 30 days, which would be unheard of. Am I hearing that correctly?
I think that's probably a little bit it's very likely that the legislature will begin considering implementation measures and regulations very soon. In fact, I heard that there may even be bills introduced this week or next week. But I think that it'll probably take a significant amount of deliberation, particularly since there are some mandates in the law that the legislature has to figure out in terms of social equity licensing, home cultivation. So I think that there could be a decent amount of time before the implementation of a regulated system. I'm not sure exactly when the legalization of possession takes effect, but that should be relatively shortly. In the meantime, it's possible that the legislature will pass something that allows medical stores to start selling for adult use. But again, I don't know if that would necessarily be as soon as 30 days. That just seems a little bit ambitious to me, particularly when you have some states like Maine, where it took almost 4 years.
Yeah, and California took 2 years. There are people that are now saying, Morgan, that New Jersey is a very important vote because it puts enormous pressure on New York, Rhode Island, Connecticut to move up to recreational, because people will be going to New Jersey to buy recreational drugs, and that's going to impact the revenue flow from one state to the other. Do you agree with that idea that New Jersey could open up most of the East Coast?
I think that it absolutely will. I mean, all these states were already considering adult use or adult use measures, and some of them were very, very close to actually enacting them, just running out of time in legislative sessions to be able to push the last final few votes in. But the passage of New Jersey is definitely going to add urgency to all of those efforts because, in addition to losing out on tourist dollars, I just think that these states don't want to lose out on tax revenue either. And speed to market is very important in the cannabis industry.
The article I saw recently was talking about this, as we just talked about the time delay to get into the market, that the illicit market became more offensive when they had that 2-year window and captured market share that will have to be recaptured by the legitimate or legalized market, so that the illicit market is going to be around. Although I heard in Colorado, most recent data is that it's not totally gone, but it's been significantly damaged by the legal market in Colorado. So what's going to happen to the illicit market, do you think?
I mean, I think that it can be expected that it's going to continue until consumers have an affordable and viable legal option in the regulated system. When that happens, it's all going to depend on exactly how the state decides to set up the regulations in a way that allows for businesses to be competitive and still maintain some semblance of a bottom line. So far, it looks like New Jersey might be one of the lowest level of taxation states because it sets sales at the state sales tax rate and only allows for the possibility of municipalities to add an additional up to 2% tax. So really, that's a pretty low tax rate for most adult-use states. But unfortunately, businesses still have to deal with the federal taxation issue and not being able to deduct expenses through 280E. So there's only so much the legislature can do without Congress making a move on that issue.
Yeah, and speaking of Congress, it looks like the Republicans are going to retain control of the Senate. The House is actually still up for grabs. The last thing I saw before we came on the air is there's something like 34 seats undecided, and the Republicans have turned a number of seats to the point that they need to get 17 seats to get control of the House. So what happens if we have the Senate and the House go Republican? What happens to the progress across the country?
Well, I think that cannabis policy reform at the federal level will continue to move, but it will probably just move in a much slower and more incremental fashion. There's still significant support in Congress, including among some Republicans, for descheduling cannabis. But I don't think that with a Republican-controlled House that those more comprehensive pieces of legislation would move as quickly. I think that we'd probably see movement on things like banking, veterans access, and research much more quickly if that were to be the case.
Now, you mentioned earlier in your conversation, I think was it North Dakota that did both at the same time?
South Dakota.
Both South Dakota. South Dakota did medical and recreational at the same time. That's quite unusual, isn't it?
It's fairly unusual. I believe that there are some cases of it happening previously, but what's really unusual is that South Dakota passed an adult use initiative without having an existing medical system. Generally, the trend has been that when you people are pretty uncomfortable with the idea of a regulated cannabis system because they don't know what it looks like. A lot of people have a hard time imagining that this substance could be regulated because all they've known is prohibition. But when you show them an example of what a well-regulated cannabis marketplace can look like in a medical context, it becomes a lot easier to envision what it looks like for adult use and to be able to really think about the idea in a concrete fashion and see that the sky isn't falling. This is something that we can do and that other states have done, so we should consider it more seriously. That didn't happen in South Dakota. This this concept won purely on the strength of the argument.
So let me ask you one more question about that. When you have both medical and recreational, do you think you really need two sets of laws and regulations?
Well, I think that there are some benefits to having bifurcated systems, particularly because you shouldn't be taxing patients for medicine necessarily, and certainly not at the same rate if you are going to tax them as you would be taxing the adult use consumer. So I think that there are considerations there. Also, there are issues with access to certain types of products that may not be very popular in the adult use market, but are very useful for patients with certain conditions. So there are a lot of considerations there. And I think that it really just depends on the necessary requirements of every state in order to figure out what the best course of action is for them when it comes to either like having a unified system or a bifurcated medical and adult use system. But it's certainly possible to do both models, as it's been proven.
Okay, so that we have just a couple minutes left. If you think about what has happened, what's the next cycle? What's the next cycle for new initiatives in other states?
Well, I mean, we're going to see legislative action in a number of states over the next couple of years. But in terms of ballot initiatives, I think that we can really look to the states that were unable to complete their campaigns this year because of the pandemic. States like Idaho and Nebraska and Oklahoma and Arkansas and Missouri, Florida.
That would be, 2022? Would it be the next major cycle?
2024, depending. Yeah, we're looking at initiatives in 2022 and 2024. I think if we're looking at 2024, there may be some additional ones, but honestly, we're kind of running out of states that actually have the ballot initiative process. These initiatives are popping up in a lot of places because they're extremely popular among the voters. So at some point, we're going to run out of states where ballot initiatives are even an option to change cannabis policy, and we'll have to focus solely on legislative efforts.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Super. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for your great insights. We've been speaking with Morgan Fox, Legislative Director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. And how do people follow all the stuff that's going on with your organization in this important market?
You can go to thecannabisindustry.org, and we're also available on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks again.
If you missed any of this great interview with Morgan, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and go to the archive section.
and you can listen to this. And there's lots of other stories by Morgan on that site. So W420RadioNetwork.com archive section. We'll be right back.
Introducing the new Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. Did you know that in 2019, almost one in five dispensaries were either robbed or broken into? Your business is cash only, because up to now, you didn't have access to a banking account that would allow you to deposit the daily receipts from your business. Some owners have started a banking relationship only to be told in a few months that the institution was closing the account. For the first time, you can now have a reliable business checking account. Yes, I said a secure bank electronic checking account. For more information, call 1-888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining me today is Mike Regan, our money guy. And we're going to talk about a lot of things, but we're going to start off by talking about just a quick overview of the 33% preliminary number on GDP that was announced on Thursday morning. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Doing pretty well, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for joining us today. Significant number, 33%. I mean, I know it's historic, but is it a significant number from your standpoint?
First, it's always the thing to keep in mind with such a large number is it was, you know, off of a, you know, such a large decline, so sort of a shift of, you know, pent up demand after shutting down the country. So it would certainly not extrapolate 33% out into the future. But it seems to have still been, you know, larger than I think a lot of economists were expecting. In terms of just sort of the, I think you have to sort of look more at the, you know, overall broader trend, but that is still, I guess, somewhat stronger than, you know, at least the people who are tracking this were expecting going into this print, essentially.
So we're going to have in 30 days a second look at the number, and then another 30 days after that, or just before the end of the year, we'll get a final third quarter GDP. Do you expect that this will hold, go up, go down? What do you think?
In terms of the broad economy, that's somewhat beyond sort of my experience and estimation. I usually look more sort of specific industries and, you know, still try to understand, you know, how individual companies, you know, growth prospects can play out. I mean, I know in terms of this one, it was driven a lot by autos, which basically like no cars were sold in April or even produced. And then that's had a rebound, and that's sort of a pretty large ticket item that, you know, shifting a few months from one quarter to another quarter can, you know, drive a big jump, but it's not so much that, you know, sort of an underlying trend. I guess it's more, you know, sort of a stronger than expected least growth rate for this period. I guess generally it's talking about sort of the strength of the economy if you're not going to lock it down. But in terms of sort of my focus, I try more to look at, you know, more specific, you know, specific industries, you know, such as cannabis, where it's a little easier to, you know, understand what the, you know, main drivers are versus the, you know, the overall economy at large.
Let's move on to cannabis. In the latest release from the National Cannabis Industry Association says that they're still on track for about a 40% growth in sales. And depending upon how some of these new states kick in on the recreational side, like we talked about New Jersey possibly being out in 30 days, we could exceed that 40% increase in sales for the year. Have the cannabis stocks in general followed the 40% increase in sales?
Well, so in terms of the 40% increase in sales, it comes down to what you're sort of looking at. But generally, through the pandemic, the cannabis sales have actually been a lot stronger than expected, part being declared essential businesses, sort of unlike a lot of other industries. Basically, the sales have continued on despite, you know, the dislocations and jobs from COVID and such in the lockdowns. Stocks in general, they especially ran up after the vice presidential debate when Senator Harris mentioned decriminalization. But the thing to always keep in mind when looking at cannabis stocks is that they're not a monolithic asset class, if you will. The cannabis industry is still smaller micro market. And the way I typically split them in my mind is the Canadian operators and the U.S. operators, meaning it's not where the stocks trade because they all trade in Canada. It's where the company has actual operations. So truly, with operations primarily in Florida, is an American operator despite its stock trading in Canada. Afria, with its operations primarily in Canada, is Canadian stock, that type of thing. If you do that, you know, basically, you know, those markets are basically very separate and have very separate, you know, investment drivers. Basically, you know, the Canadian market is the fundamental story there is still price pressure and margin pressure from oversupply of product, and the company is trying to right-size their cost structure. In contrast, the U.S. story is primarily, you know, states declaring cannabis essential things, you know, the company seeing stronger than expected growth and then hopes for incremental legalization or, you know, loosening of the illegality in the U.S. So if you break it down by that, oh yeah, just to your question about the stocks, though, you know, basically for the past month, the, you know, American operators are up about 16% on average. You know, the Canadian ones are, you know, up 6%, but there's an awful lot of, you know, divergence within that, you know, between like Aurora being down 22%, you know, on the trailing month, essentially.
So let's look at some events and let me get your feedback. The largest market in the United States is California. They've got fires going in the growing areas, and they've been going on for weeks. Now we had fires that are now breaking out in Colorado that are threatening the Colorado crop. So if we have significant destruction of the crops in Colorado and in California, what does that do to the price of the raw product?
Well, I mean, any product, it's dependent on supply and demand. So if you reduce the supply, the price will typically go up. And that actually, you know, even in Colorado before the fires, you know, it snowed last September, you know, it snowed about a month ago. And that there was a lot of fears that that would actually, you know, harm the crop because they hadn't been harvested yet because it was such an early frost. That's sort of standard with any agricultural product. But yeah, if you know, if a significant amount of supply gets destroyed by the fires or by, you know, the weather, that would reduce the supply, increase the wholesale price. And then it's a function of if the, you know, the demand continues to grow. I mean, both those areas are still seeing, I mean, California report, you know, according to Headset, grew about 35% in the month of September. Colorado was up about 37% in the month of September, and these are still large, mature markets. So it remains to be seen if the fires have really started to, I mean, obviously they destroyed some crops, but it remains to be seen if they're going to actually drive pricing, you know, disrupt the supply enough to actually drive, change the pricing dynamic within the sector.
So if I look at the price of cannabis in California and Colorado over the last 30 days, has it stayed the same, not gone up?
Hey, I actually don't have that specific data at my fingertips
right
now. Some sources of it that have that, I just don't, I can't opine on the actual move that recently or that sort of that quickly.
Okay. So we're looking at the fires and snow. I guess another major snowstorm is coming in this weekend. But if this is an agricultural crop, at least for people who grow it outside, it's subject to weather conditions, just like corn or wheat or soybeans or anything else. So I look at the growth rate in sales and the expectation they'll grow even more. There's been some discussion about that the real growth rate in the legal market is coming from the illicit market. Forecast were that would there be about $67 to $68 billion of sales in the illicit market, and now they're thinking maybe it's going to be 63 or 64, with a decline switching over from the illicit market to the legal market. And I'm trying to figure out, why would a person who's been buying cannabis illegally all of a sudden switch to from illegal to legal when these dispensaries are open right next door or on the same street as the legal dispensaries? The governments don't seem to be doing much about them. So why would they assume that a consumer would change their buying habits?
Well, that's basically one of the key legs to the revenue growth in cannabis. Is the thing to always remember with cannabis is it's a growth market from the legal cannabis market is a growth market for investors. It is not a new market. It's an existing market that's just uninvestable and untaxable for governments in the illicit market. I mean, you threw out about $68 billion. for many estimates, sort of in the 50 to 70 billion range. But the key growth dynamic for the first, you know, for cannabis at first, there's basically two legs of it. The first is gaining share from the illicit market in the legal market, gaining share from the illicit market. And you asked about converting customers over. It essentially comes down to the price has to be competitive enough. The product quality has to be there to, and the shopping experience convenient enough to first convert the users that are used to doing it on the illicit market. And then it secondarily then brings in the second growth phase, which is converting people who aren't heavy consumers at all, or not consumers at all, or not heavy consumers from the illicit market into consumers in the legal market. You know, the person that wouldn't buy from the illicit, but then is happy to buy from the legal market. And that's basically the first leg of growth. And we've seen that in Colorado, where sort of no hard estimates on this, but you're seeing the Colorado reportedly is basically shifted primarily to the legal market from the illicit market. In California, where the dynamic is more what you're talking about with, you know, especially in Southern California, you know, there's issues of the sort of a gray market where you're not quite, the customer may not even realize the dispensary is technically illicit by not tracking the product, not paying all the taxes, not having all the licenses, et cetera. We've just seen in Canada, because the interesting thing about Canada is the government actually reports their estimate of the illicit market in their GDP reports. They, for the first time in the second quarter, the legal market overtook the illicit market in Canada. So according to the Canadian government, I think it's now 51% legal, 49% illicit up there. So, and again, it comes down to the price has to be low enough, the quality has to be there, and the shopping experience has to be convenient enough to convert those initial users. But that's a much lower bar for sort of new users who didn't consume in the illicit market and are now entering the legal market.
Well, unfortunately, Michael, we're out of time, so thank you for joining us today. Would you tell our audience how they can follow you and get your words of wisdom?
Sure. So I publish my research on my website, mjresearchco.com. That's MJ, the word research, co.com, and that's where you can find comp tables and additional value-added research coming soon.
Super. Thank you for joining us. If you didn't hear all of Mike's interview today, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and listen to not only this show with Michael, but previous shows with Michael and other people on the... If you didn't get a chance to hear all of this interview with Michael, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and you can go to the archive section and listen to this show and other appearances from Mike on America's Cannabis Conversation. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us for another appearance on our conversation is John Kega from Africa. Last time we talked to him, he was there taking care of his parents, and he's still there. He said he's coming back this weekend. But John is the Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data. It's a big research house on the cannabis space. And John, thank you for coming back to the conversation.
It's a delight to be back, Dan. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. So let's get right into it. We had some ballot issues yesterday on cannabis. And the sale of cannabis, both medical and recreational. How did the vote go yesterday?
So yesterday was another historic election for the cannabis industry, for the cannabis legalization movement. And in fact, I would say this may prove to be ultimately one of the most consequential election cycles that we've had for cannabis. So we had five states that were voting on cannabis with six different cannabis-related initiatives. And let's start first with the adult use legalization measures. Here we have four states that were voting on adult use. New Jersey, Arizona, Montana, and South Dakota. And on the medical side, you had South Dakota also having a medical measure on the ballot, as well as Mississippi. Now, all of the measures that were on the ballot passed and passed comfortably. And part of the reason why I say this is such an important election in terms of what it means for the future of legal cannabis in the U.S. is if you look at the geographic distribution of the states that passed measures, you know, you had New Jersey, which becomes a new anchor for adult use legalization on the East Coast. You have Montana in the Northwest, which kind of brings legal adult use cannabis into the Great Plains. You have South Dakota, which was the first state ever to propose a dual, two different measures on the same election cycle. And it's the first state to ever go direct to adult use legalization without first having a medical program in place. And then you have Mississippi, which continues to break down kind of this southern wall. You know, the South has been one of the slowest regions of the U.S. to legalize anything, either medical, and there's no adult use. But the addition of Mississippi to Oklahoma, which is already a very strong performing market, I think starts to suggest that, you know, on a national basis, at a time when, you know, this election is a nail biter, we are, you know, 24 hours in and we still don't know who the president or how the Senate is going to play. But cannabis was decided on and the public has voted decisively. And the fact that it's across diverse states, the fact that some of the margins with which these initiatives passed were, you know, 2/3 in New Jersey, 67% voted for it in New Jersey, I think is just an amazing indicator of how far the public has shifted on this issue and how much movement we continue to expect in the years ahead. As cannabis continues to expand nationally.
John, the person in charge, I think maybe it was even the governor in New Jersey, said earlier in the week, if this ballot initiative passes, that they thought that the existing dispensaries, which were medical only, could be doing adult use within 30 days. Is that wishful thinking or is that possible?
That's entirely possible. And, you know, there's a reason why giving this or making the transition as seamless and expedient as possible between medical and adult use makes a lot of sense. The longer that you leave between the passage of the adult use measure and activation of the market, the more time you give to the illicit market, the unregulated market, to take hold. And ultimately, you've seen, even in places like California, that, you know, that two-year gap that California saw between legalization and activation of its market has meant that the legal operators are now facing a huge challenge, the illicit market being their biggest competition. So the idea of giving the medical license holders the ability to literally flip a switch and start serving the adult use market with minor modifications to account for the different consumer profiles, I think is a smart decision, and I think will enable the states to begin earning revenue from this pent-up demand very, very quickly. It's something that we really haven't seen done before, but we think it's a really smart strategy in terms of ensuring that you don't give any room for the unregulated market to take hold in that regulatory period between passage of the measure and activation of the market.
So, John, how much of the support of the legislation was driven by a need to find sources of additional revenue because of the pandemic devastation of the economy for the states, tax
so
revenue?
That's a great question. And we think with particularly in places like New Jersey, in particular, but maybe to a lesser extent, even in South Dakota and Montana, the drivers, I actually think, are much more based on the public being ready for this. You know, mm-hmm. in In New Jersey, the measure passed by 57%. In Arizona, it was at 60%. In Montana, at 57%. These are really big coalitions that I don't think just the issue of tax revenue alone, it helps broaden the tent, but I don't think that's the only issue that brought people to the table. I think there's a strong recognition that, you know, the enforcement of prohibition has been inequitable, and there's people who are drawn by that issue. This strong kind of just public acceptance of legal cannabis. I was struck by a study that Gallup released earlier this year that showed that 70% of Americans now view smoking cannabis as morally acceptable. So the idea of, you know, the stigma surrounding cannabis, I think, has largely and very quickly eroded. And so I think the preponderance of the driver here is this dramatic shift in public attitudes around cannabis, with the benefits around tax revenues being an added bonus to bring in particularly fiscal conservatives who are realizing that law enforcement is very costly, and two, that there's actually real money to be made through legalization.
John, there's been some stories that the most important, and you kind of alluded to it a few moments ago, the most important vote was in New Jersey because it creates enormous pressure on New York State, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut to join the fold, or if they don't, their citizens will wind up going to New Jersey to buy legal cannabis. You think that makes sense?
We not only agree with that analysis, we actually think that the impact of legalization in New Jersey is going to extend even further down the Mid-Atlantic. I think this is going to place to drive additional pressure in places as far south as Delaware, Maryland, potentially even into Virginia, which is now trending blue. And the reason we say that is this, you know, in a way that you don't see in the western states, the eastern seaboard, so that corridor between D.C. and Boston, has one, really high population density, and two, really kind of great mobility and transportation access. So it's really easy to get from, say, Washington, D.C., which is about as far south as I would draw this line, into New Jersey. And we think that, you know, the demand that New Jersey is going to see from regional tourists is going to make the market size of New Jersey's adult use program dramatically larger than what it would be if it were fueled just by in-state demand. And I think there's going to be a lot of governors, a lot of state kind of government officers that are going to be looking at their residents driving up to New Jersey, spending a lot of money in New Jersey's economy, and that's money that they're losing from their home states. They will start looking at this, to your point, from a purely kind of quantitative financial view and saying, hey, we're burning a lot of cash here that or our consumers are spending a lot of cash here that we should be earning. And, you know, is this something that we should be considering? And given the fact that, one, this is money New Jersey is going to be earning that would have otherwise been spent in local states, two, COVID has had such acute impact on economic fortunes of state and local governments. And then three, given that some of the markets with the highest use of cannabis are in the Northeast, means that you have kind of all of the makings for intense pressure on lawmakers in this region to follow suit now that New Jersey has done it.
John, let me take your last comment and expand it just a tad. Given the number of states that came on over yesterday and where we are, have we reached the watershed level that is going to put pressure on Congress and the administration to finally deregulate or decriminalize marijuana on a national basis?
So that's a great question. And
I'm two for two, John.
And we actually did some analysis around this, and we are, at the first time now, going to have an incoming class of members of Congress, a combination of House and senators, House members and senators, who you have a larger proportion of members of Congress representing states where adult use is legal than representing markets where cannabis is illegal. And so when you take the combination of both medical markets and adult use markets, you have about 70% of members of Congress now representing jurisdictions where cannabis is legal. And even though there remains, you know, quite a lot of lawmakers, national, federal lawmakers, who may not necessarily be in support of cannabis, you know, they do have to increasingly serve, or they'll be increasingly driven to serve the interests of their constituents. Now, given that we still don't know what the makeup of the Senate is going to be, we're awaiting those results and expect to have them by the end of the week. It's too early to tell whether the Senate will flip to the Democrats or whether it will stay in the Republican control. I think the likelihood of fundamental reform happening under Republican Senate leadership is far lower than it would be under Democratic control. But to your point, just because there are going to be so many more legislators representing jurisdictions where it is legal, does, I think, add a lot more animation and energy to the national debate around federal reform.
Well, we've been speaking with John Kega and of the New Frontier. I happen to be able to get some of the research that his company publishes, and it's really great stuff. John, tell people how they might follow you and get information from New Frontier Data on the cannabis industry.
Thanks very much, Dan. You can find us at newfrontierdata.com. That's newfrontierdata.com. And we have some new reports out, including an analysis of the election, the impact of the new states that have just legalized. And we've also just released our latest U.S. trends update. So some great resources here to provide, in which we share our perspective on the size, growth, and evolution of the U.S. market.
Super. We've been speaking to John Kega, and he is the Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data. It's always a pleasure to have you on, John. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dan.
Now, if you missed any of this great interview with John, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, go to the archive section, and download this show and other appearances by John and a bunch of other great interviews from people who've been on the show for the last year. We'll be right back. Okay, I'm going to reset. And where are we? There we go. Okay. So now we're going to talk about what are the longer-term implications of the passage and expansion of the market. Okay?
Yep.
Sounds All right, good. Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us for another conversation is John Kega from the New Frontier Data organization, which is one of the top analysts and research organizations on what's going on in the cannabis industry. John, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be back, Dan. Thank you for having me.
We just saw in the recent election, I think it was 5 states that either provided medical or adult use, and in the case of one state, 2 at the same time. We were expecting that the sale of cannabis product was going to come in about a 40% increase this year over last year. New Jersey, which passed enabling legislation, said they could be selling by sometime in mid to late November, so they're not going to get a lot of time. But what are the implications of these states, and do we see other states coming in next year to further expand the market? What's going to happen to the revenue growth in this industry?
So we see phenomenal potential upside now that we have the addition of these 5 states, and I think the prospects of future states over the next couple of years look really strong. So just first context, we find it more important to talk about kind of what the out years look like rather than the first couple of years, because regulation, implementation, and policy all influence the first couple of years. But once they start cooking with gas, you have a good sense of how these markets grow. Mm-hmm. We're forecasting that the addition, just these new states that have been added, the 5 states, Mississippi, South Dakota, New Jersey, Arizona, and Montana, will collectively add an additional roughly $3.5 billion to the revenues being earned by the legal market by 2025. And you know, so in an environment where every dollar counts, you know, this is a pretty substantial kind of catalyst for economic growth. And that doesn't include any assumptions about what might happen on the federal level around national legalization. And critically, it also does not include any assumptions about what might happen in the years between now and 2025. So we expect that, for example, next year, New Jersey and Pennsylvania are very likely to advance legalization measures through their legislatures rather than through ballot initiatives. We think in 2022, Florida is a really good candidate to legalize adult use. They weren't able to get them on the ballot this cycle. They're going to make a big push for it in 2022. And then, you know, once you have big states like that, I think you start looking at other markets like Texas, like Virginia for Texas for medical use, Virginia for a robust medical program. And starting to fill out some of the other markets in the Northeast. And so the upside potential here, I think, is very, very consequential. But we are conservatively estimating that just with the states that are now currently legal, by 2025, you're looking at a market that will be at about $38.5 billion by year end 25.
So let me play devil's advocate, John, if I might. And I'm not saying this to put you on the spot. It's just that it's a question I've been thinking about. I have seen reports that that as much as $3 to $4 billion of the increase in the legal market this year, increase in sales, is a fundamental shift of not growth, but a shift from the illicit market to the legal market. And so, and you're looking at your growth forecast, how much is do you think is pure new customers, and how much might be people who have been in the illicit market and are switching to the legal market?
Really important question. And one of the things that we have been saying from the outset is when you flip that switch from illicit to adult use, and this really isn't applicable to the medical market because of the restrictions around participating in the medical market. Specifically speaking about turning on an adult use market, the overwhelming demand that you see for the first few years is driven by consumers transitioning from the illicit markets to the legal one, not by new consumers who are saying that it's legal now, so I'm going to try cannabis for the first time. And so we think you're right. Your assessment is correct. The bulk of the growth that we have seen in the legal markets this year and indeed in the past few years has been driven by consumers who are looking at the trade-offs between the unregulated market and the legal one and finally finding that the value proposition of the legal market is appealing enough for them to want to make that transition. And let's use Colorado as an example.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I was going to take the other side of that issue, but you go ahead and finish what you want to say, and then I'll ask you another question.
So using Colorado as an example then, you know, Colorado has now been legal for a little over 6 years, and we have seen the market grow phenomenally over that period. But based on our estimates, the legal market is still only serving about 80% of the total demand in the state. So even after 6 years, not 100% of consumers are participating in the legal market. There's still upside room for growth. So it's also important to understand that just kind of flipping the switch on doesn't mean immediately that all the consumers in the unregulated market will immediately make that transition. And there's a number of different reasons for that. But it takes time, and it takes time to create a regulatory framework and a market environment that pulls in this huge diversity of consumers into the legal market. And so for these less mature markets, whether you're looking at places like Nevada or Massachusetts, which have recently activated their adult use programs, Michigan and Illinois, they have quite a few years of very strong growth that's going to be largely driven by existing consumers moving out of the illicit market rather than by new consumers who play a smaller role, important but a smaller role, in driving market growth.
So let me again play devil's advocate. There are people in California, for example, the largest market in the country, who say that the taxing powers of the state of California have made the difference between the price of the illicit market and the legal market so dramatic that people who are in the illicit market, it's a better value proposition for them to stay there because the cost structure to go into the legal market, it's much more expensive to buy cannabis legally than it is illegally. Why would people give up the illicit market at a lower price to go to the legal market and pay a higher price?
So this is actually a question that we have looked at iteratively and expansively over the past few years. And one of the things that we've learned is that consumers are willing to pay a small premium for all of the benefits that come from being in legal market. So being able to walk into a store rather than dealing with some dodgy guy in some dark alley, getting products that are beautifully packaged, that are well branded, that are that you get this diversity of product forms that you just don't find in the illicit market because you don't have the kind of commercial research and development infrastructure in the illicit market that you can build in the legal market. You have testing and quality, and you know you can actually see what's in the products you're ingesting. These are all benefits that, and you can actually talk to a bud tender or somebody in store who knows what they're talking about, who knows what products you're buying from. So these are all benefits that consumers are willing to pay for as a premium over the illicit market, but they're not willing to pay double the illicit market for those benefits because they already have good access to products that they're comfortable with. And mm-hmm. So California has been a study in that thresholding of how, yes, even in California, the legal market is growing. I think it's worth underscoring that, it's not growing as fast as it could be if they reduce their taxation significantly, but it is still growing, which shows that consumers are, even at 50% taxation, consumers are still willing to pay a premium even that high because of the benefits that they see from the legal market. But we think that the taxation in California has been a critical reason for that market's underperformance. And we think that market could have experienced dramatically higher growth or dramatically faster growth had they reduced substantially that taxation point.
Yeah, the other thing about California is that if you look at a map of California and look where the dispensaries are and are not, there's a huge part of California that has no dispensaries at all that the local governments or cities have prohibited. And so the growth potential of getting those government agencies who are going to need revenue to change creates an opportunity because they're not getting any tax revenue from the illicit market for the legal market. Let me move on one more step. You said earlier that you thought that if the Republicans retain the Senate, that it might be more difficult.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.